In the very early days of Verging, Branson actually gave away too much equity.
Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, his approach with the co-founders at the time initially had 50% and Eduardo had 30%.
Now let's talk about the company valuation. So many founders, I think, focus on really getting that highest valuation possible.
Beyond valuation, there are things that impact your equity. It's things like share class.
Next, we're actually going to listen to our very first founder dilemma on a co-founder situation, and we'll share our thoughts, so stick around. Today, we're diving into a real critical topic for every startup founder, how to think about equity allocation and master your cap table. This is probably one of the most critical aspects when you're starting out your business, and one that was actually requested by our listeners. So if you're in the early stages of building your company, thinking about equity allocation, this is the perfect episode for you. I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria. And why are we speaking about this? So Yvonne and I have invested in over 100 startups. So we've seen co-founder splits and flavors in many different ways. And we thought to bring those experiences to life here today for you. Now, equity allocation in the early stage is not just about your spreadsheet. Yes, it's numbers and it all needs to add up, but it's also what will decide the foundation of ownership and control of your company in the long run. Today, we're going to break down three mistakes, tips that you should keep in mind as you think about setting up your cap table. And we're going to also have a bonus tip at the end. So stick around. Yeah. And in our usual fashion, we're going to bring stories like, for example, Mark Zuckerberg, how he's done that with Meta.
Amazing. Let's get straight into it. So the first tip that I would say is be really strategic about your early equity with co-founders and advisors. Many founders actually give away way too much equity too soon, especially when bringing in co-founders, advisors, and early employees. Just to share some examples, in the very early days of Verging, Branson actually gave away too much equity to keep the business afloat when he was raising capital for it. And what he had to do is buy back shares later on down the line in order to maintain that premium and regain control. You do not want to be in that scenario. So you want to ensure that in the very early stages, you're thinking about how you're giving away that equity. Because there's many, many examples that we will share throughout this episode where too much has been given out too early or not enough what has been given in those very early stages.
And I think that co-founders are one that when you start, that's the first folks you're going to give equity to, your co-founder. You either are starting it all together, you're starting and then bringing your co-founder on board. So this one is very tricky because there's no one size fits all, right? Some founders lean towards, oh, if you know, off the bat, it should be equal risk, equal responsibility, equal splits. If we're all starting on it full time and we're all starting at the beginning, everyone should take equal splits. If it's two founders, 50-50. If it's three, 33-33. Now, there's another camp of people who believe that, look, it depends on who's actually driving the business. Who is the person that without that person, that business cannot succeed or it will be completely different? Who is the person who's taking more risk, who's senior, more junior? They should hold the majority of the shares. What we've found in our experience is that there's really no one size fits all. Different founders do it many different ways. But if you look at the story of Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, his approach with the co-founders at the time, and we all know the story that they eventually fought and split and everything, but Zuck initially had 50%. And Eduardo had 30% and they left the rest for like equity stock options for employees. But then he later actually recapitalized. He reduced from 50 to 40, but then Eduardo 30 to 24 and then left more room for a third co-founder. And so I think this is just to say that you could do it very many different ways. In fact, Carta, you might know of it, says only 41% of two founder teams actually split equally. So some people choose to split equally and others don't.
Yes, the Carta insights on this is actually really incredible. We will include it in the show notes. But on equal splits with two founding teams, one of the things to be really careful about is deadlocks. Oftentimes, investors want you to be able to break a tie, which means that a 50-50 split doesn't always work. Sometimes you see founders doing like a 51-49% split, really but ultimately we do see a common split of 50-50 to ensure alignment. It really does boil down to trust. Also, many founders really actually swear by 50-50 because they believe it gives equal responsibility, commitment, and incentive. But ultimately, there's no real one size fits all. So you have to really think through what truly works for you. On Zuckerberg, when he was building Facebook, he actually structured his equity and voting shares in a way that allowed him to retain control, even as he raised billions and billions of dollars of funding. So key takeaway here is use vesting schedules and cliff to ensure that equity is earned over time and that you're not giving away too much upfront.
Absolutely. And what are vesting schedules and cliffs? It might be something you know of, or maybe not that much, but it's pretty much getting ownership over time. So on the day one, you don't issue the 100% of the shares. Say you had two co-founders and they did split 50-50 and split. On day one, if you are vesting over 5 years, you get 10% of the company every year for 5 years for one co-founder. And the same thing for every co-founder. So if the co-founder maybe left 1 year, they would only get 10% as opposed to the 50% on the first year. So that kind of just aligns incentives and makes sure that in the long term, people actually stay for long enough to be able to earn the equity that they have. Now, cliffs, on the other hand, are essentially a step in the vesting schedule. In the example that I gave, say a founder has 50% and they did a 5-year vesting schedule, meaning that they earn their 50% over 5 years. So they get 10% every year. A cliff is when they have to think of the way a cliff is, you have to go over that cliff before you earn it. So if the cliff was, say, 1 year, they would actually not earn any shares up until the first year. So if they left a day before the first year anniversary, they would earn zero, even though they've been working on it for a year. But if they waited till the year, they would earn that 10% and so on and so forth. And in terms of the vesting schedule, it could actually be annually, it could be quarterly, it could be monthly. So you could be earning it monthly over time. So that's just an example of how to think about vesting schedule and cliffs. And it's a very strong mechanism to protect and align incentives for everyone involved.
Yeah, and there's a founder that Maria and I have both backed, actually, that has a vesting schedule as long as 6 years. Typically, we see these range anywhere from 4 years, but nowadays, we're seeing companies stretch them even further, just given how long it takes to truly build a category-defining business. And that's something that you might want to consider. Now, on employees and advisors, it's really important that you keep an employee share option pool. You want to have a way to incentivize new employees as the company grows and scales, and actually exist employees too. And yeah. So what is the employee share option pool, or ESOP as it's also known as? This is typically a proportion of the company that you grant or hold as options for employees. And it's a really powerful tool to attract, attain and motivate employees, especially when startups are honestly not able to offer the same salaries that a normal company would. The same could be applied to advisors as well. So you could provide your advisors with equity. Have a think about that. Always try to maintain an ESOP. Typically, we see this ranging from anywhere from 10%. I've seen ESOPs go right up to 20% as well. You want to find a way to incentivize those employees that come on, particularly those that come in the early days. Next, we're actually going to listen to our very first founder dilemma on a co-founder situation, and we'll share our thoughts. So stick around.
So welcome back. Now let's take this dilemma very first from one of our listeners. So it says, "Hi Startup Leap team, thanks for the amazing content. My favorite episode is the episode with Nadia Odunaya of Storygraph. I found it incredible. Now onto my dilemma. I'm the founder of a consumer brand startup in the UK, which I co-founded with a partner. We initially split equity equally without a contract or agreement. And for the first few years, things were going well. However, a year in, the dynamic has shifted significantly. I've been putting in far more work while my co-founder is increasingly occupied with other commitments. At this point, it feels like I'm running the business alone, and I believe our equity split no longer reflects the reality of our contributions. I've already addressed this with my co-founder, asking whether he would dedicate more time, he said he can't, or consider reducing his equity share, he refused. We're now at a deadlock. I have committed significantly more time and money. I'm feeling increasingly resentful. I'm now considering legal action, but I'd love to know, how should I approach this situation? And in hindsight, how could I have structured things differently to avoid this issue? Would appreciate your advice." What do you think, Yvonne?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think since their co-founder isn't really willing to adjust the equity or increase their commitment, I think there's a few options. First of all, reframing the conversation around the fact that, do they want to potentially ask for their equity back and discuss what's a fair contribution?
He tried that. The co-founder said no.
He's willing to step down to an advisory role where he's still contributing, but not fully invested, and then seeing what equity is actually correlating to how much they're putting in. And if that doesn't work, I guess checking their legal position. Things can get really sticky if you don't have a founders agreement in place. But the key is just to focus on how to move forward. And I think at the end of the day, you'd rather have a piece of a bigger pie than a piece of no pie. And so I think the co-founder just really needs to understand implications that this could have on the business if they don't come to an agreement.
First, one thing that I honestly believe, especially with co-founder situations, is that it all boils down to trust. Once you cannot communicate, that's the beginning of the end. And I've seen so many founders where they start off pretty good, but once that communication breaks down, it goes off. Honestly, it doesn't need to get to this. This is an extreme case, and it also just shows maybe the breakdown in trust, in the fact that they've not been communicating. And it seems like it's one-sided. So one person is trying to communicate and the other person isn't communicating.
But what I would say as well is for anyone listening that may want to avoid this type of scenario, instead of giving 50-50 up front, founders should always have that period that Maria touched on earlier. And this is a way that you can ensure that if someone does walk away early, they're not leaving with a huge chunk of equity, which could obviously impact your fundraising in the future. And I think, as I mentioned, have a founders agreement where you have defined roles and commitment levels outlined from the very early stages. Who does what? What happens if the founder doesn't contribute? Exit clauses to really put in place some sort of ideas around what to do in these situations, and a plan for the equity dynamics as well.
So one of the feedback that even in our previous episodes is try before you buy, essentially, like work together and build those muscles of communication, because they don't necessarily come naturally. As human beings, we're likely to not want to have difficult conversations. So building those muscles together before actually getting to a situation where it then gets extreme like this. The other thing, and I think Yvonne has touched on it, is the contract and the agreement is very important off the bat, just to give a sense of what's happening. I already touched about the vesting clause. If that was the case here, maybe the founder could have gone away with much less equity and the business can still continue. But if they're co-founders and they split for equally, and now they're in a deadlock situation, one person is not speaking, the business cannot go forward. I would say that in retrospect, a contract, but beyond a contract, a vesting clause, a buyback clause. How do we get, if anything happens, if priorities change, things happen, how do we get it back? But I want you to know that despite all of this, if there's a breakdown in the relationship, I've seen it, it doesn't matter. Things just get really messy and things get really bad, which is why who you choose as a co-founder at the background is really critical. I would say keep trying to have that conversation, but if it comes down to it that you can't, you might have to exit the business and move on.
I think the founders agreement vesting schedules would have probably alleviated some of these problems. Now let's jump back into our tips.
Welcome back. So on the second tip is raising the right amount at the right time. It's tempting to take the largest check on offer, especially if you get that opportunity. You just started, someone is offering you an incredible amount of money as the valuation for your company, and you're like, yes, that's not what your company is valued at, because you don't have revenue yet, most likely. Valuation is very nuanced in early stage, so it's still very much changing. But in that early stage, some founders might raise too little, and we often see this actually with founders who are like, oh, I don't want to give too much of my company too quickly. That general sense is okay, but you can raise too little at a too low valuation. And then some people,
it's really a balancing act.
It's very hard, because you can't say raise this amount, because It really depends. And you know what? It actually also depends on the business model, don't you think? There are some business models that don't actually need you to raise that much money. And there are some that counterintuitively need you to. So for example, I was speaking to a founder recently, and she was talking about a space tech startup that's building space tech, both software and hardware. You can't give the same advice for SaaS companies, for a space tech company that needs infrastructure. And beyond even the infrastructure, they probably need to be very well capitalized before they can get on some of the clients that they need. Or maybe like a financial regulated startup that needs some heavy capital requirements. So I guess the gist here is really figure out how much your business needs and try not to raise too little or too much. But I would say, to just end my thoughts on this one, is it's really not about the valuation, it's about the dilution. From a venture SaaS standpoint, we tend to see between 15-20% or 10-20% dilution. Some founders go as low as 5 and some go as high as 30, but those would be extreme cases in my opinion.
Yeah, 30 is definitely. And I think just coming back to that point around how you should think about what you need, how much the valuation should be. Key thing, in my opinion, is just really around what milestones can you achieve with the money you raise to help you get to that next round. Because really, when you do raise the round, that should just help you get to that next phase. Just another key point that I wanted to draw out. Now, let's talk about the company valuation. So many founders, I think, focus on really getting that highest valuation possible. But actually, the high valuation can cause issues later on down the line. So 2020, 2021, we saw a number of companies raise at significantly high valuations. But when they came to raise their next rounds, if they hadn't had the growth to really grow into that valuation, then it caused a number of issues. So let's put it into perspective. Let's say you're a pre-seed company, you raise that valuation of, say, 50 million. You then go on to raise your next round. However, revenue is only 100K. How do you justify that next round valuation? And so that's another thing that you should really think about. So I've had a number of companies approach me, having raised rounds at significantly high valuations, they go to raise their next round, and it's really hard to grapple with trying to either come in at a higher valuation, or what you don't want is a down round. But some companies have to do that. Facebook had a down round, right? It's not the end of the world, but you want to avoid that because it means that you result in extra dilution when you don't really need to, if you had just had a reasonable valuation at every given stage.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because there's the high valuation part, but there's also the low valuation part. There are founders that I know that have raised on incredibly low valuations where it's, this is not a venture investable company anymore because someone owns like 60% of the company and it's not even the founder. And I'm like,
like a founder had said that they gave away like 50% and this was like a seed stage. They were raising a seed round and I was just like,
no investor is going to come into that. Yeah. And it's not just because they don't have enough room to actually participate in the company. It's also, if you, the founder, have 10% of the company, I'm sorry, you're not incentivized. There's nothing you can tell me. Like, you're not going to work as hard on the business as if you had a more significant percentage. And this changes, obviously, over time as the business grows. There are companies right now that IPO that founders own single digits. It's normal later, but the earlier stages, you want to have enough. Now, on the low valuations, where I tend to see this happen is sometimes with accelerators. And this is a double-edged sword because there's some really good accelerators or programs that it's worth the ownership because of the value that they create and they unlock very quickly for you to have a higher value and kind of de-risk you. But not all accelerators are made equal and you should do your research. Another thing that I see, especially with first-time founders, is maybe you just started and maybe there's an angel who says, oh, this is exciting, I want to invest, but they're like, I would take 40%. You're like, you don't really know. You're like, I own 60% still, so that's fine. No, you really need to think about it in the context of your business model, what's typical, the funding you would need to get to the outcomes that the angels and the investors are expecting of you later down the line. And I know that some of our listeners and our audience don't necessarily, you're not necessarily building just tech startups. So this is very much the VC tech type startup. If you are building a tech startup, this example makes sense. Just to give you a sense. Every VC expects that you will raise money, you will continue to raise. We talked about it in one of our previous episodes where we're like, if you're going on the VC track, you're probably going to need to raise. And you might start at, let's just give an example, 500K at a 5 million post-money valuation. Now, post-money is just after we invest, that's the valuation of the company. It adds the money we invested into the valuation. And then you raise other rounds, 1 million at a 10, 10 million at 100 million at 500, 300 at a billion. Now you're a unicorn. After all of this, if you are a two founding team and you started with 85 or 90% at the beginning of your company, let's say you kept 10% aside for employee stock options, you now have about 17% of the company individually after all of this dilution because of the money you've collected. Now, this is assuming that the investors don't even ask you to increase your equity allocation pool or something else dilute the shares. There's a lot of assumptions in that. And I would even say that's a conservative estimate. So just to let you know that as you raise money, you are getting more diluted and tracking it. In fact, one of the founders that I spoke to recently said he's a lawyer and he's a founder and he's been a founder for 6 years now. Even I was shocked by how diluted I was over time. That founders don't think about it. And you really need to do the math. You really need to bring out that Excel sheet and say, if we raise at this valuation, how much does that dilute us? And go so forth and so on.
Absolutely. Tip number 3, negotiate terms beyond valuation. Many founders focus solely on the high valuation, as we touched on before, but seemingly investor-friendly terms can lead to unintended consequences.
Yeah. Beyond valuation, there are things that impact your equity. So it's also rights. It's things like share class. It's things like your information rights. It's things like where investors have say or not. So I would say like the entire gist here is beyond the value of the company, there are many other things that you can actually use as levers that ultimately impact the equity. So just really thinking about that when you think about your negotiation on the cap table.
Yeah, and I think there's many great lessons in history, as always. So if you look at Snap's Ivan Spiegel, he structured his fundraising rounds with dual class shares, for example, and really ensured that he retained voting control as new investors came in. Now, this won't work for every investor, but this is why it's really important to think about everything from like liquidation preferences, voting rights, board control. It's just as important as the valuation and the money that you have coming in.
Yeah, and I would say that if you think about the different levers, so for example, dual class shares, actually Mark Zuckerberg used this very well to retain ownership and control. I would even say like more control than ownership. And if you think of dual class shares, so just like very quickly, shares, you're essentially selling pieces of your business, but you can literally create classes of shares that have things that they can do, and they can have super voting, they can have rights, and you offer the shares to investors that have maybe lower rights, and then you keep shares to the founders or certain investors that have higher rights. Now, a huge caveat. We're not all Mark Zuckerberg. There's a dynamic in terms of leverage experience that you might be able to use as leverage in these conversations. Many times you can't quite pull these things, but they're good to know because at the end of the day, as a founder, you're still in the driver's seat, right? And you can decide whether or not you accept a check or you don't and what terms ultimately. Now, dual class shares allow for that. It's just essentially creating separate class shares that allow for you to do more things on one than the other. Mark Zuckerberg, like I was saying, actually did this where his shares, the founder's shares, actually have super voting rights. So say, for example, Class A and Class B, they have 100 million shares. And on the Class A shares, it's not one for one vote. It's actually each vote counts as 10 votes. But for Class B shares, it's one for one. If somebody did a vote based on the number of share, it would count as one. So just imagine how that skews the conversation, where on one class, it's 10 votes to one share and another class is one to one. Then the other one is liquidation preferences. This one is very important because people don't really think about it. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but when you think about share classes, they're actually usually in two classes. There's usually a common class share and there's a preferred share. The common class share is often what is traded publicly. But for private companies, sometimes there's a preference share. And that preference share is what investors tend to want. And the reason why it's a preference share, if you hear the name preference, preferred, is that in the hierarchy of when maybe the company gets an exit or is bought or sold, that preference share is actually higher than a common share. Most founders, their share class is actually common share. So there's almost like a hierarchy. It's usually debt, preference shares, and then common shares. So after you've paid your debtors, the preference shareholders, who are often the investors, so think about an exit, your investors will collect their money first. Now, this is where liquidation preferences come in. If I invested $10,000 and I have a 1x preference share, I'm saying that when you're paying in terms of the arrangement, pay me the preference shareholder, pay 1x my original amount. So 10,000, I get my 10,000 back. And then I get whatever I need to get from common shares, because oftentimes there's common shares equivalents as well attached to the preference shares. But if it's a 2x, even though I invested 10, when the exit conversation is happening, you will pay me 2x my original 10,000. So that's 20,000. Now imagine if I invested 10 million, 30 million, 100 million. It means you need to pay me that X factor, 2X, 3X of what I originally put in. This can be dangerous. As a founder, you might not get any money at the end of the day because everybody has all these preferences. You could get the highest valuation, but if the liquidation preferences are not in your favor, that might not actually work out well for you in the long run.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And along with liquidation preferences, coming back to voting rights, as Maria touched on earlier, if investors get voting rights, I think it's really key to try and ensure that they are proportional to their ownership and do not exceed like standard investor privileges. One book that I really recommend when it comes to all things technical, legal, when it comes to the way in which venture deals are actually structured is Venture Deals by Brad and Jason. Highly recommended book. Personally, I don't think any founder should raise money without reading this book.
Yeah.
the basic knowledge is around all things to do with term sheets and the documentation. Now, the other thing that I want to highlight is limited protective provisions. Now, oftentimes in investment docs or when you receive your term sheet, you will see that there are certain rights and things that require investor approval. Now, this is pretty standard and it can include everything from hiring executives to how much you spend on particular areas of the business to even selling the company. However, one thing that I do want to highlight is where there may be overly restrictive terms, that's something that you just want to push back on. And so it's really important that you have a good view on what some of those overly restricted terms are so you can push back on that. So again, it's not just about the money, it's not just about the valuation. You really need to understand some of these legal technicalities as well, because it could have a substantial impact on the way in which you run your business and how you actually navigate your journey as a founder. Now, we have a bonus tip for you, so hang on.
Fantastic. Now, welcome. Our bonus tip is smart equity structuring. Another thing to think about is not just how much you give away, but how you allocate it. One thing to note is that to keep your cap table clean, and your cap table is essentially your list of shareholders, you want to syndicate small checks into an SPV. So when you start off, oftentimes you're starting off from checks from friends and family, maybe a couple of thousand here and there. It's very difficult administratively to have all of them in your shareholders agreement doing that. Now, we have things like safes, we have some legal agreements that make it easy to do, but still, you probably want to coordinate people into one entity and have them sign agreements as a whole entity because they're smaller checks. This will save you a headache later down the line when you're trying to get everyone to agree to things. There are platforms that actually help you do this very simply. There's AngelList, there's Odin here in the UK, there are a few other platforms, check them out. This is not a sponsored statement, by the way. It's just, these are things that you can leverage. So yeah, really think about structuring and the admin of your equity as well.
Yeah, and be really smart around how you structure your equity as well. If you have an employee share option pool, you actually don't have to just allocate that to new employees. You can actually continue to distribute that to existing employees as a way to incentivize them. And actually, one of the founders that we spoke to as we were thinking about this episode shared the fact that in one of his companies, he actually thought about distributing some of those option shares to his existing founding team to incentivize them over the year. So every year they would distribute some of that as a great way to incentivize them and increase their equity ownership over time. And so you can actually get really creative with how you think about incentivization. This is not like a one playbook for all companies. Really think about what works for you, and you can get creative as well.
When you think about share options, a bit of a technical point, but share options are not technically shares off the bat. So it's just a pool for shares you will allocate. So options actually mean something completely different. You have to buy the option, almost like a right to buy. So when you issue it, they actually have to buy it, but it's often at a discount to its future price. So it can be very lucrative. So there's still that nuance there. But especially in VC, Yvonne, I'm sure like 100% of the founders you've invested in, at least for me, it's 100%, maybe even close. It's like they all have a share employee, like an ESOP, like an option pool. Because at the beginning, you can't compete on salaries. You don't have it.
So there you have it. Three key ways to preserve equity and one powerful bonus tip we have for you as well. Be strategic with early equity allocation with co-founders and advisors. Raise the amount at the right time that you need. Negotiate terms beyond the valuation. And don't forget the power of smart equity structuring.
Absolutely. And yeah, managing your cap table wisely can be the difference between success or failure. If you found this episode helpful, make sure to subscribe, leave a comment, tell us what you think. And remember, this episode was actually as a result of someone commenting and saying that we should touch on this. So if there are any topics you want us to really deep dive into, we'd be more than happy to do that. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Leave a review. Tell us what you think of this episode on all our platforms at The Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guest. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.